Welcome to Good Natured, a podcast where you can join us for uplifting chats that shine a light on conservation challenges.
Each week we interview inspiring conservationists from lots of different backgrounds who each engage with conservation in their own way. I'm Julia.
And I'm Sophia. Today we are thrilled to be speaking with Rachel Ashibofe-Ikeme.
And get ready to hear about conserving chimpanzees, the importance of mentorship, and also being a woman in the field.
Hi, Julia.
Hi, Sophia.
Today, we are super excited to have Rachel Ashibofe-Ikeme with us. Rachel won a Whitley Award in 2020 for her work on chimpanzee populations in southwestern Nigeria and the Niger Delta.
Rachel is the project director at the Southwest Niger Delta Forest Project, and she's also an alumni of the Dorrell Institute of Conservation and Ecology, which is also known as DICE, and she holds a degree in conservation project management from there.
As you will hear, Rachel does many types of work and has many goals, but one of the things that she's trying to do at the moment is aiming to secure 20% of chimpanzee habitat in southwest Nigeria.
And we're going to touch on lots of different topics today, be it being a woman in the field of conservation. We're going to talk about the importance of mentorship. So we can't wait for you to listen to the episode. And just for you to know, in this episode, we are going to discuss sexual harassment. So a bit of a content warning. If that's not something you're comfortable with, you can skip that bit and it will be between 18:30 and 20 minutes.
Let's talk to Rachel.
Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the Good Natured Podcast. We're so excited to have you with us today.
Hi.
To kickstart the podcast, could you tell us how you became a conservationist?
My journey to being a conservationist is quite non-traditional, shall I say, or atypical path. I actually studied public administration for my first degree in the university. So it just happened that I was like a fresh graduate, fresh out of school, and just really looking for job opportunities. And how was your, should I say, very unconventional job seeker, because I was like applying for anything and everything I was seeing in the newspaper ads and all of that. And so, yeah, I stumbled upon this vacancy ad for interns with the Nigerian Conservation Foundation. That was kind of like the beginning of it all for me, because a week or so later, I was told that I passed the interview and test and I should resume for work as an intern with the Nigerian Conservation Foundation. And so I did. And I started learning about conservation at that very point, at that very moment when I joined the organization as an intern. I was gorging on every information I could get out there. I became fascinated just by the thought of the knowing that we had wildlife resources, biodiversity, and we're not just doing like learning in the office. They were taking us out to the field to learn. And it was at that point also I was able to see firsthand the conservation issues that was just confronting wildlife, confronting us as people. I think I was just that person, and I'm still that person who felt like, oh, there's a problem, and let me just try and get it fixed. And I think that's what I've gotten me to this point. And I think looking back, I probably wouldn't think that it was such an easy thing to fix, you know? But that was my mindset at the time. I felt, oh, there's a problem. I could fix this problem. And I think that's what made me plunge myself into conservation the way I did.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but that was when you became engaged in conservation, when you got this first job and internship.
Yes, yes.
Had you had any experiences in nature as a child or not really?
No, not at all. I didn't watch National Geographic. I didn't know about David Attenborough. For me, I didn't have any of that. My parents were a lower middle class family. We grew up in what you could term like a cosmopolitan city in northern Nigeria. And yeah, so we were just like very average life. So I didn't live close to a park or a natural area. I didn't visit any zoo. So I had no clue, like absolutely no clue. In Nigeria, there is what we call the National Youth Service Corps.
So it's a mandatory one-year youth service for everyone who graduates from the higher institution. And you, like, it's sort of like seen as you serving your country, where they post you to different parts of the country from where you have grown up or where you have lived or schooled. At that time, I was posted to a local community. And in that community, it was like a small village that had lots of trees. And at that time, I would always watch, you know, daily, I was just always seeing like truckloads of trees coming in, like logs of wood coming in, like very large wood coming into that place, you know, bring that, that's been brought into that sawmill. And I remember very, very, very well, very vividly, that whenever that there were certain days, I would just sit and wonder how it is that where these trees and these logs were coming from. And because this village where I was, I didn't really understand the language of the people there. I just really couldn't ask anybody about it. But it was something I pondered about a lot. In the first month of my internship, one of the things we were exposed to, or the opportunities that were available to us, was to meet with renowned conservationists across the country. So I remember we had this meeting with Professor John Oates. Later on, or eventually became sort of like my professional mentor. And I remember it was the first meeting with him, and then he was telling us about conservation issues in Nigeria, about how he started his work ever since in the 1960s in the country and all of that. And then he was saying something like, the most significant conservation issue to wildlife in the country is hunting. And I said to him, no, it's not hunting. I imagine I like someone who is clueless about conservation, who is clueless about anything to do with, I was arguing with this expert, with this, you know, someone with many years of experience. And then my only knowledge for arguing with him about this issue was just because of my experience in this very village I'm telling you about. And then I said to him, it's not hunting, that's habitat loss. The situation had played in my favor in some ways, because he took note of me out of the six interns that we were at the time. And then we exchanged emails, and it was from that time on that we formed this kind of very good professional working relationship.
So your focus now is largely on chimpanzees in southwestern Nigeria and the Niger Delta. What are the biggest threats that you've identified in the area?
Habitat loss is certainly the most significant threat. I mean, you could go to a location today and see a group of monkeys, for example, red colobus monkey, or you see chimps in a particular site, you see their nest, looks so nice, you take your GPS recordings and coordinates, and you write a nice report about it, you know, you start knocking on doors, offices of government officials, and asking them, do something, there is this population of chimpanzee here, these are the signs, these are this and that, and you use that GPS locations to trace your way back there to see how they're doing. And that place, it's not even a forest anymore. I mean, within a space of months, I'm even talking about less than a year, within a space of months, the whole place, it's another land use type, is totally converted. It could be human settlement, it could be anything else, but not forest, not, and it's no longer habitat. So yeah, it was a complicated problem. It was sort of like complex. There were complex issues that were driving this forest or habitat loss, and it wasn't that straightforward to address them either.
In the past, you've described a multiplier effect, in that conservation benefits for chimpanzees or other single species can also apply to other species. How have you seen this come to life in southwest Nigeria?
The chimpanzees share their habitats with others, like in southwestern Nigeria, with other species like forest elephants, other primates as well, red-capped manga bay, which are now endangered, the Nigerian white-throated monkey, the Nigerian potty-nosed monkey, and all of these are all threatened primates, and they share their habitats with these primates. And so when you find that their habitat overlaps with these other species as well, you realize that there is no way you'll be driving conservation efforts for chimpanzee that it wouldn't impact positively for other species who also share that same habitat. So we have seen, I can tell you firsthand, say for example, one of the protected areas which we have just created in southwestern Nigeria. We are now beginning to see a comeback for some of all these other primates, and we are seeing them close to our field camp. And before, you couldn't even see them anymore. So, and that is a real big issue. And that is to also show the extent to which conservation was badly needed.
That's always amazing to see how by protecting like one species, you then end up protecting so many others. It's always very inspiring to see. And I just wanted to ask you, so obviously the chimpanzee is such a charismatic, emblematic species. What is your experience working with chimps?
It's really, really difficult because you hardly see them. You just have to rely on their signs that they leave behind, which is their nest. So we would rely on those nests. We rely on vocalizations. Chimpanzees are very social animals and they will vocalize a lot when they are together. But then being able to trace them doesn't mean it will be easy for you to track them down and get to see them, take pictures, do videos. You know how it is for us conservationists. We kind of like get very excited when we are able to make such sightings. And yeah, we sort of like kind of live for those moments. But it's not always the case in a place where there's been heavy hunting and logging in that habitat, where there's been real human disturbance in that very habitat. I mean, we've had an occasion where, and this happened in the Niger Delta actually, where we kind of like camped out and staked out a group of chimpanzee. We found out where they were sleeping and woke up like 4 a.m. and tried to track them down. And we're just so determined to be able to see them. And at that time, I was collecting genetic sampling for chimps. So it wasn't just the ambition of trying to see them or having just that kind of goal. But the goal was really to collect as many samples as possible. So if you are sure they have been in an area, it will be easier for you to look for feces because they would, you know, most certainly poop. So really, that was really the main goal. So we stayed out this group of chimpanzees under the tree. We assumed that they had slept because we heard the vocalization out there 4 a.m. in the morning, and we were just there till 6, 7 a.m. and we discovered that they outsmarted us somehow, left the tree without making one single sound, and then they just like escaped into the forest, and we just weren't able to see them. And we just also weren't able to see those fecals, their feces, as we had wanted at that very point. So it was so disappointing. Okay. But that's how much hard work that goes into, you know, trying to monitor the chimps.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you've had some amazing experiences just tracking them. And of course, it's hard work, but it sounds like you really love working with them as well.
I just love all your anecdotes as well. It makes it like so vivid and real. So you have previously said that women are often disregarded as agents of change in Nigeria and in conservation. So what has your experience been like as a woman in this field?
It's a good question. Well, it's a very difficult one to answer because say, for example, if you're facing an issue, no one is going to tell you it's because you're a woman. My conservation work started in 2005, right? So at that time, besides even being a woman, I really didn't have any, should I say, role model. Like, I didn't see anybody become a field-based conservationist. That's even male, whether male or female. I had to develop my own interest in conservation and how to build myself up. Of course, I mentioned the help I got from people like Professor John Oates, who would review my report. But besides that, in practical terms, in terms of being in the field, I didn't have anyone to pattern that after. I started out doing field-based conservationists as a team leader. So that was by itself a challenge, especially considering the fact, of course, like I said, I didn't have the biological background. I just had to learn through the way, which was doubly challenging. Now I had to start leading teams. And this is where the challenge as a female presented itself. I was leading an all-male team. I was very sick with fever, but at the same time, still waking up 6 a.m., 7 a.m., putting on several kilos of a backpack on my back, and then walking several kilometers across this landscape daily. It was high fever. I mean, it was so severe. But you know, I couldn't, because I was so afraid that if I showed any sign of weakness, it would completely be looked down upon by these team members who were just waiting for me to, you know, fall apart. It would seem like it was insecurity, but it was very strategic for me, because if I showed them any weakness, and I knew for sure if I should tell them that I was tired, no, I was ill, it would still come across to them as, no, she's a girl. She has gotten tired of this whole thing. So we knew she couldn't keep it up anyway. So it would translate to them in that sense. So that was my life for the next couple of years. Every time I was in the field doing work, I couldn't show any weakness. I couldn't, you know, I just had to keep up.
That's so awful. I'm so sorry you had to go through this. And, you know, working when you're sick and when you have a fever is just not something you should have to go through. But I see how in that context, you know, you felt that you really had to in order to prove yourself.
Looking back, I wouldn't do such a thing today. So fast forward to when I started my work with CHIMS, and now I was transitioning from being a conservation researcher to being someone implementing conservation actions. I became an advocate for conservation. I started to do campaigns and meeting governments and community leaders to conserve species. So now the game kind of like, the ball game changed. I've proved myself in the field. And it was at this point I started seeing the other side of being a woman as well, because I've seen other male colleagues do this aspect of work before. And I've not seen them being in any ways disregarded, at least not in their face. Even people at the community level who would rightly like tell me to my face, like, is it like you don't have a family, you're not married, as in who let you come out here to do something like this, looking for monkeys or whatever. You get those questions directly. Yeah. And they stare at you like, well, they give you that impression and make you know that you just wasted your time coming all the way. Now, the reason why things seem to have changed now is because I just have persisted. You know, in the same communities where they saw me before, they keep seeing me now. They grew up just like getting used to me. And then they've come to that point where they're like, maybe we should probably listen to her. Maybe we have started to see the signs of what she has been telling us all this while. So not that any of these have stopped, but it has kind of like improved over the years. Like for me, I just develop a thick skin for it. And then at the same time, I brush it off, and then, you know, now I guess I'm so used to it that immediately after that, I'm not shocked, I'm not surprised, I'm not offended, I don't feel insulted, nothing. I just continue on like, you know, nothing has happened. But I think recently I was sharing with someone too that if not that, I have most of the time, like I'm the one leading the team, I probably would have faced more sexual harassment than I have. There was a time I was a trainee and I was amongst like this all men training, and we're all trainees and they were all guys and I was the only female. And it was the only time in my own history of doing conservation that I experienced sexual harassment, you know, from fellow trainees and in the field. Working in the field and we were trying to escape an approaching elephant. And then at that moment, it just quickly threw his hands on my breast. And then after the whole scene, after we left that place, I met him later on in the camp in the evening, and I confronted him with him. I said, you did XYZ. And he totally just denied it. But I knew what happened, and it was so hard. And because we are Africans in the African setting, it's just very recently that these issues of sexual harassment, rape became very prominent and people started discussing it more openly. In those years I'm talking about, in the beginning when I started, when all this happened, you don't talk about things like that. You never say it openly.
Well, you can face retribution, right? Like if you say it, then it kind of comes back to you.
Yeah, it's like the lady in question asked for it, or she made herself, you know, available for it. So it's always one of those mentalities that people you are reporting to have.
So people not being responsible for their behavior either. not being accountable.
But other than that, yes, that's just mostly, just that situation, being a woman in the field, is, you know, in conservation, has just been that challenging.
I think that it's these experiences are so much more common in conservation field work than we ever acknowledge. Thank you so much for sharing those experiences with us. So my next question is kind of like thinking about the people that you have encountered within conservation. And it's a question that we're going to be asking all of our guests this season. Can you tell us about another conservationist who inspires you and why?
To be honest, I think it would sound so cliched or so, you know, redundant to say, but I would just say it's Professor John Oates. He's someone I got to know professionally and even to some certain extent personally, because I worked very closely with him at some stage. And when I went to UK to study for my master's in University of Kent, he lives not too far. He lives in the same county as Kent. So I got to meet him and his family during that time and share some good times with them while I was there. And I would say that I've been so inspired by him over the years, by his work ethic, by his passion for conservation, by his passion for building African leaders in conservation. I've seen him up close, and it would be very hard for me to call someone who is very distant to me as someone who inspires me when I've not really seen them up close, what they are like, maybe challenging situation. Every individual has their good side and their bad side, or is it their positive and their negative? I don't know what to call it, but yeah, but for me, from all I've seen, I've learned from him. I think he's really inspired a lot, as in there are times when I've really felt like, you know, giving up, but he has kept at encouraging me, even though he himself does not feel encouraged by situations on ground. And yeah, I would really name him as someone who's really inspired me over the years. And this is from the very beginning to this day. So that's almost 20 years now.
It's such a lovely tribute. And I love what you said about how sometimes the people that we admire most, in order to really admire them, we have to know them up close, because sometimes you imagine somebody who's far away and you're inspired by them. But when you see somebody up close and the challenges that they have and everything like that, then it can mean something completely different.
Yeah, because it's very easy to see people's strength on TV, in papers, but when you don't get to see their weaknesses, you don't know. When you see your own weaknesses, you won't know how to pattern your reaction to those moments. When you're able to see how certain people react to challenges and how they confront it, you see their strengths, you see their weaknesses, and you're able to learn also from their weaknesses as much as you learn from their strengths. Because
yes,
I can look at Jane Goodall and think, wow, great, you know, and call her my mentor or like an inspiration, but I've never really met her, and all I see about her or know about her is right on the internet, or that's everything I get to see. And real life conservation work isn't that. It's a lot of challenges. There are more challenges than there are successes. And then if you spend the whole time just waiting for the successes to happen, you miss opportunities to be able to reinvent yourself during the times of the challenges. And this is what made people like Jane Goodall who they are today.
Rachel, I feel we could talk to you all day long, but we are going to have to wrap up. So we wanted to ask you one more question, which is something we ask all our guests again. And that question is, do you feel optimistic about the future of nature?
What makes me optimistic is the people. I've seen a lot of things, especially if you work in Nigeria landscape, you would have 1,000 reasons to be pessimistic about the situation and about whether there is hope, a better way for people to relate with nature. But in my opinion, or from what I've seen so far, I've seen optimism in the people, whether it's in the local communities, whether people in the local communities or people in the government who have the power to change things. I've been so optimistic at the way that we humans, we can really, yes, we can really be bad. We can be destroyers of nature. We can be the worst thing that ever happened to nature. But at the same time, we can also be the best thing that happened to nature. And that happens in a season or in a period of transition, in a time when there is a turnaround in the mind of people concerning how they relate with nature. And I have seen that. I've seen people totally change, do a complete turnaround from, you know, wanting to destroy nature to being advocates for nature. It all has to do with, I think, how we are able to make this conservation relatable to these persons. I mean, how do you make conservation relatable to a two-year-old? How do you make conservation relatable to a government official who has spent all his life in politics? And we are seeing all of that. We are seeing a growing number of young people who come from the age of 15, even 14, even less, younger people who start advocating for nature. So I would say the greatest optimism I've seen really is in people. And I think people really have the capacity to be the biggest champions for conservation.
That's amazing to hear. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for speaking with us. I feel like we have just had such an amazing conversation.
Thank you for having me. I'm really grateful for the opportunity.
I feel like we've covered lots of different topics. And the one I wanted to talk to you about first is, again, like this question of having mentors and how important they can be. And I really loved how in her story, she, you know, kept repeating how Professor Oates has really been important in terms of shaping her career, but also in terms of providing that mentoring at the very beginning when she wasn't really sure of what being a conservationist even meant.
Yeah, I loved that. And I really loved the way that she made the distinction between the people who we think are great on TV and the people who are great in reality. And the way that kind of witnessing someone's struggles and seeing how they deal with challenges is a really great type of mentorship, because maybe you can model your own attitudes and actions on that.
For sure. And I think that's something that you can really do at any point of your career as well. Like, you know, you might be a student or you might be a professional, but you always have these other people that you see in roles that you might want to be in the future. And I think unconsciously as well, you kind of model your behavior based on what you're seeing them do. And that's something that is really interesting.
I can imagine Rachel being a wonderful mentor to people as well. She is so honest about the difficulties she has faced, but then also she is so determined in terms of the change that she knows she wants to make. So I can imagine her being a really wonderful example as well.
Yeah, and I think that having that empathy as well is so crucial if you're a leader, just like making sure that you can show as well the weaknesses and what you've gone through, and that you show it's okay to go through rough patches. I feel like that's something that sometimes we want to pretend that we're like strong leaders and we don't want to show any of that. But I think it's super important for other people to see that actually sometimes you fail and that's okay, and to actually see how you deal with that.
Well, she was very open with us about that, but she also talked about the ways that she had felt like she wasn't able to show weakness at other points, specifically because of being a woman and worrying that she wouldn't be taken seriously. And I mean, she knows the context, like she probably wouldn't have been taken seriously.
Yeah, it's a very difficult balance, isn't it? Between you have to, I feel like if you're a woman in leadership, you have to walk that tightrope where you, again, like want to show empathy and show that, you know, you're not a robot, but at the same time, you also don't want to be seen as weak or seeing as like you're not doing enough compared to male leaders.
I think it is a much more sensitive spot. And in some ways, maybe we put extra burdens of expectation on women when they are leaders because they're expected to be empathetic as well as kind of going above and beyond and hitting these goals. For me personally, just thinking of mentors, I have had some really amazing woman mentors. I mean, my PhD was co-supervised by two women. Seeing different lives of women and seeing all of these examples of really incredible women who I would like to emulate in some way has probably really shaped my perspective.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it was also very thought-provoking what she described in terms of being a woman in the field as well and the challenges that came with that? Because again, if you're in conservation, I mean, it depends on your jobs. Like for me as a science communicator, you know, I don't necessarily go to the field that much. But if you're a field conservationist, then you are facing all these difficulties as well. Like, you know, just making sure that you're taken seriously, sometimes having to pretend that you have a boyfriend so that people don't harass you. And there's like so many different layers.
Yeah, so many different layers. And then also there's just such a range of challenges. I mean, just in the ones that Rachel described, you could really see how some of the situations that she's come up against are really subtle. And even she said it. And then there are these other situations which are really glaring and completely unacceptable as well, which just really reveal the assumptions and perspectives of some of the people that she's working with.
It's just so important that we realize all these different aspects of like what being in the field actually entails and the challenges that can come with that, to just make sure that we have stuff in place to make sure that people can do the field work safely as well.
Completely. I mean, it's really important to talk about those things.
But I think another reality, isn't it, is like the reality of like what it means as well to be in the fields. I feel for a lot of people, you think conservationist and you feel like, oh, they're chasing animals, like they're out there in the field having a great time. And it's actually quite hard, isn't it? I mean, I've done field work where I was meant to look for bird species. And I remember just days and days and days of walking in the Atlantic rainforest. And sometimes, you know, I would spend an hour or two walking and seeing nothing. I think that's also an interesting aspect of field conservation, that people sometimes have a bit of a fantasized version of what it might look like.
Yeah, I mean, it is this trade-off, because you get to be in these incredibly beautiful places, you know, and be studying these questions that you're so interested in. But it can definitely be very physically demanding, and I think at times a bit monotonous. Rachel clearly has existed in these spaces with such stamina and just determinedness. And I love that, especially because she talked at the beginning of the interview about how as a child, she never spent time in nature. And I really identified with that because I grew up in Mexico City. And sometimes I kind of felt like, I mean, once I sort of became older and got on the path of conservation, there was a part of me that was like, oh my God, when I was a kid, I didn't go and climb loads of trees. I kind of hated camping, and still yet I am a conservationist now. And so I kind of loved hearing this upending of the traditional narrative of like the Gerald Durrell type childhood of just going around and spending loads of time with animals and in nature. And then that was how you became a biologist.
Yeah, it's definitely an inspiration. And I think it's a great point on which to end this episode. And as usual, if you want to review us or rate us or subscribe or just tell a friend about the podcast, that really helps people know that we exist. And again, you can reach us if you have any thoughts about this episode, if anything resonated with you. You can either send us a message on Twitter at conservoptimism or send us an email or a voice note at podcast@conservationoptimism.org.
If you are a brave person and you send us a voice note, you might even find it gets featured on the podcast.
The Good Nature Podcast is hosted and produced by Sofia Castello-Etiquel and myself, Julia Minier. Our music is by Matthew Kemp, and our transcripts are available thanks to the help of Alexandra Davis. This season of Good Natured is supported by the University of Oxford's Departmental Public Engagement with Research Seed Fund, Synchronicity Earth, and the Wheatley Fund for Nature.